You may then begin, Mr. Mack.
Thank you. I really dislike it when the other party waives oral argument because I don't get to react to their points, but be that as it may. If the court would look at page 46 of the transcript, it's pretty clear that the respondent in this case was asked, acting for punitive damages in the contract. He states that the $1,500 is placed in the contract as a motive to pay up. And it's also fairly clear under Frank versus Johnson, which I quoted in my memorandum, that a punitive damages clause, whether in a written or an oral contract, is not allowed. The liquidated damages clause is, but there was nothing in the oral contract that indicated a rational relation of the damages to the clause. There's no measure of damages for conversion, which is fair market value. Nothing in the contract about that. There's no
Except in this
rational
case,
relationship that.
counsel, the trial court found that $1,500 a month was not a punitive award, but actual damages.
Yeah, but
Did
they're
the court?
wrong. The point is that the Mr. Rossow explicitly said it was put in the contract as a motive to pay up. And so the finding that it was a rational relationship is not based upon any legal evidence.
$1,500 wasn't in the contract, was it? It was the claim for damages at trial. And there was
Exactly,
testimony that supports that, did it not?
exactly. But the point is that the testimony at trial is that the $1,500 was something that was industry standard, if you want to put it that way, to give a motive to the buyer to pay up. And a motive to the buyer to pay up is a punitive damages clause. Now, there was
Wasn't there also testimony that $1,500 represented the value of the equipment rental, and the district court determined that that's what appellant lost as a result of not being able to use his equipment?
Here's the problem with that. There was virtually no attempt to recover the equipment. He could carry on his business without getting the moving equipment. There was just one matter in 2015 where he said he wanted to come and get his stuff, and that was it. There's a duty to mitigate damages in a case like this, and damages could have been mitigated very early. They could have been
Well, except
mitigated by
that
his
there's
picking up his.
no pleading suggesting that mitigation of damages was part of this lawsuit, is there?
Well, first of all, of course, this is a pro se litigation, and I suspect virtually any lawyer would have put that in. But we give some at least leeway to pro se litigants and matters which are plain error and which should plainly be before it. And any judge in any case like this would have brought up the issue, if there were an attorney, of mitigation of damages. It's just there. You can't get everything just and what 6 years between the move and the time that this case went to district court to pick up his stuff. Moreover, he eventually did pick up his stuff, and that brings to the issue of whether you can sue for both damages and conversion. In a case like this, there would be
Well,
double
this wasn't a
recovery.
conversion suit. This was a replevin suit, wasn't it?
It was both. If you take a look at the complaint, it sounds in conversion. He was given damages in conversion, and he came and picked up his stuff as well. So now there has been a little bit of breakdown of the old rule saying you can't sue for both conversion and damage. Well, you can sue for them, you can't get them both. There's been some breakdown of that, but the issue of double recovery is still there. He got his stuff back. And he got award for damages in part to stuff.
But he didn't have the use of that equipment over all of those years, and that was the basis for the damage claim, independent of getting it back as a replevin.
Well, here's the problem. At any time, he could have gotten it back. In fact, he came out there to get it back at one point, and they had a quarrel and almost got into a fight. But then he had another 3 or 4 years to get it back.
And during that time, your client didn't provide the pad in which to drop this building and take this equipment away, did he?
No, but that didn't prevent the defendant and plaintiff in this case from taking it away. The other problem, of course, in a case like this, particularly a pro se case, is there is no indication of what amount he'd be charging, whether there would be a late fee, whether there would be a fee for withholding the property, and so forth. This is the kind of contract that ought to be in writing if you're going to do this sort of thing. I think one of the things that's very interesting in this case is the difference between the damages in conciliation court, which were nominal, and the huge amount that was ultimately awarded by the court in a case like this. For example, the amount of damages awarded was three times the value of the shed. My client had already paid $5,500 for the move. So I submit.
What's the legal authority that would limit the district court's ability to award damages that would be in excess of what conciliation court did?
No, of course they could do that. There would be cases where you would award damages in excess of both the conciliation court and the value of the property. But this isn't such a case. This isn't the kind of case, for example, where the plaintiff came on the property and my client shot at him, which would certainly award damages in excess of the value. But I think it's a good indication to the court what a learned judge thought really the value of the plaintiff's case was here.
Why wasn't the respondent entitled to the reasonable value of the use of his personal property?
I think the
during those years that it was holding up your client's building.
I think the answer to that is that if somebody is going to ask for that sort of thing, they got to notify the other party of the problem. For example, during the 6 years, Mr. Rosso never said to my client.
It seems like 600.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? I'm going to be hitting you up for $1,500 a year unless you complete this contract. And he didn't. And you've got to have some kind of indication of the vulnerability of a person in a case like this, where going to be asking for damages well in excess of the value of the property involved. I wanted to discuss one thing here. Unfortunately, that's one of the problems with not having my opponent. And that's the issue of plain error. Obviously, my client didn't preserve some of these issues, but because he was pro se. But I think you have all the elements of plain error in this case. I think there was error for the reasons I've been discussing. I think it would have been pretty obvious to any judge, certainly would if there was a lawyer there. And it was horrendously prejudicial because my client winds up paying three times as much as the property is worth. And the
Mr.
other
Mack, is there some authority for us to apply plain error review outside of the criminal context instead
oh, yes.
of instead? Instead,
some of it in my
in
my
Mr. Mack.
Mr. Mack, could you allow the judge to finish his question,
I'm sorry.
Please?
I thought
so. As an alternative to plain error review, we do consider certain matters forfeited in civil cases, and do not then go on to address it under plain error review. So the question is, what authority is it that says in this kind of a case we would use plain error review as opposed to what we typically do when someone doesn't bring up an argument below in a civil case, which is to deem it forfeited?
Well, I don't have any of that before me. And one of the problems is the other side isn't here, but I didn't see any authority that they brought up that in a case where you're dealing with a pro se litigant who obviously isn't going to know the preservation issue, that the court takes a rather lenient view of that. And I think that's what we have here. Obviously, if I had been a lawyer or any other lawyer, I suspect with any experience, this would have been an motion for new trial or a motion for amended findings. But I think that this court, where you're dealing with, and it does have some lenience for pro se litigants, have got to consider these issues on the basis of the record and not simply on the basis of post-trial motions. Since I don't have my opponent here, I'm pretty much through, and I'll answer any questions.
Are there any additional questions from the panel? All right. Thank you, Mr. Mack. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision in the time required by statute. We appreciate the arguments in the briefing today. Thank you.
Thank you.